Well, good evening, everyone. I've given maybe dozens, probably hundreds of talks in my life over the past 20 years. I don't know why I feel so nervous tonight. But it's tremendous to have so many people here and in the overflow place at the Lake Street Church and watching online. I'm really grateful. And I will try to make this evening worth your time. I want to start by thanking Neighbors for Peace for initiating this event and for making sure this dialogue is happening here in Evanston. I also want to thank the Evanston Public Library and the director, Karen Danchak-Lyons. Now, some of you may have heard that we had a little controversy about this event a week or so ago, although it seems like a month. And I want to say that Karen has been nothing but gracious and supportive in the past week in ensuring that this event goes ahead and that every detail has been meticulously thought of, and I'm very grateful for that. And I wholeheartedly endorse her words about the role of a library as a public square and a place for discourse. There's one other person I would like to thank who couldn't be here tonight due to a prior commitment out of town, which is Leslie Williams of the library, who I had been speaking to over the past few months about this event and had been very supportive in putting it together. And I spoke to her and asked her, I spoke to her and told her, first of all, that there's a lot of people here, and it's a shame she couldn't be here. I'd been expecting her. I wasn't fully cognizant. And I asked her what she might say, and she sent a few kind words a few minutes ago that I asked if I could share, and she said that when Neighbors for Peace first approached me back in June about bringing Mr. Abonnema to Evanston Public Library, I was thrilled at the chance to host such a distinguished writer and thinker, which is very kind of her. As with many other standalone author and speaker and documentary programs we've presented on contemporary issues, I hoped that Mr. Abonnema's book talk would be an opportunity for those with a wide range of opinions to meet, learn, and amicably discuss their views. When I learned that tonight's presentation might be canceled for lack of a credible speaker with an opposing view committed, I was devastated but relieved and delighted that thanks to the efforts of a great many people, that decision was reversed. I'm proud to be part of a community that cherishes and supports intellectual freedom with no qualifications or equivocation. I welcome the chance to collaborate with any local organization interested in library public programs. But there's no hurry. I'm not planning on leaving anytime soon. Enjoy your evening. And I think that captures, I think, what has been kind of the essence of the discussion about this. And although some sharp words were exchanged on Twitter and in the public, I have to say that at the end of the day, we all came to the same conclusion, which is that even difficult and controversial issues, especially difficult and controversial issues, need to have a safe place to be discussed and aired. And I'm very grateful again to Karen and to the library for allowing that to happen tonight. So this book, there's much in it that I would like to share with you, and I hope you will pick up a copy, not just because I wrote the book. Of course, I'm biased. But there's a very altruistic reason, which is Bookends, which is a 6-week-old bookstore in Evanston, is here selling the book. And so it's really a way to support a new bookstore and another important part of the community. We face the prospect of a world without bookstores, and if you want to avoid that, buy my book tonight. There's much in this book that I would like to share with you. It deals with, I think, some of the toughest and hottest contemporary issues about the question of Palestine. One of the questions it asks is, does Israel have a right to exist as a Jewish state? It's a claim that is often made and seldom examined, and so I do that in the book. I talk about a one-state solution, and that's a question I have written about for many years and I think remains relevant. I talk about the economics of neoliberal Palestine, and where Palestine as a sort of an economic, a dystopian economic experiment fits into the contemporary world. I talk about the BDS movement and the war on campus, which is also now being fought. One of my friends and colleagues, Stephen Salaita, is living testimony of this. He has just been summarily fired by the University of Illinois for tweeting his disgust at the massacre in Gaza. And it appears he's the target of a well-organized campaign to punish him and, I think, to intimidate scholars and educators in general away from talking about this issue. So really, you know, the issues in this book, we are living them. But what I really want to focus on and dedicate the evening tonight is Gaza. And I'm going to start by reading a section from the book. Of course, this book came out in March before the current massacre. But what's so missing and so absent from the coverage of Gaza is any kind of context. And so I had the opportunity to visit Gaza in May 2013. It was an incredible experience. I was there for a week, but it was a week in which I barely slept. And Gaza is smaller than Chicago, so I was able to get to most parts of Gaza. And that means that just the past month of the Israeli attack has been, of course, I'm not going to compare my situation to that of people in Gaza, but it has gone from being an Israeli attack on a place that was to me imaginary in a sense, because I hadn't been there, to being an attack on friends, on places I know. I've had this experience over the past few weeks of a number of friends in Gaza sending me text messages or emails during the brief minutes they have electricity with different versions of, you know, if I don't survive, I want you to know this, or I want you to remember this, or I want you to make sure that you tell people something that they wanted to share. And that fear of that death could visit anyone is very real. In the past month, more than 1,900 people, 1,960, according to the United Nations, have been killed. That's more than one out of every 1,000 residents of Gaza. One out of every 1,000 residents. If you were to scale that up to the United States, that would be more than 320,000 people killed in the space of a month. We don't have anything, which means what? That means more than 100 9/11s in the space of a month. We don't have anything in our history, at least not our recent history, that can relate to the scale of the catastrophe that has been visited on people in Gaza, is being visited. So I want to read this segment that gives some background, and then I'm going to make some comments about what's happening now, and then hopefully we can have some discussion. And the context that, you know, before this part starts is that Gaza has been under a very tight blockade or siege since about 2006. It has also been subjected to successive Israeli military attacks since 2006, the biggest being one called Operation Cast Lead in end of 2008, beginning of 2009, which killed 1,400 people, and another attack in November 2012, which killed about 175 people. Given what I knew about the effects of the siege and the economic situation in Gaza, I was struck when I visited at how supermarket shelves in the territory are stocked with Israeli goods, priced beyond the reach of many impoverished families. This is a result of a strategy more radical than anything seen in the West Bank to destroy Palestinians' economic self-sufficiency while directly benefiting Israel. Gaza is at the leading edge of what Harvard scholar Sarah Roy calls Israel's deliberate, considered, and purposeful effort to transform the Palestinian economy from a captive economy restricted to fluctuating levels of growth, but still possessed of the capacity to produce and innovate, to an economy increasingly deprived of that capacity. During Operation Cast Lead, for instance, the Israeli forces invading Gaza destroyed the chicken farms of Sameh Sawafiri and his family in the Zaytun area. Over several days in January 2009, the UN-commissioned Goldstone report records that Sawafiri and other witnesses hid in terror as they watched Israeli armored bulldozers systematically destroy land, crops, chickens, and farm infrastructure. In all, 31,000 of Sawafiri's chickens were killed. He estimated that 100,000 chickens had been killed at other farms. The widespread destruction was confirmed by UN satellite imagery. In discussing the army's assault on the farms in the Zaytun area, the Goldstone report states, "The systematic destruction, along with the large number of killings of civilians, suggest premeditation and a high level of planning. It finds that the Sawafiri chicken farms, the 31,000 chickens, and the plant and material necessary for the business were systematically and deliberately destroyed, and that this constituted a deliberate act of wanton destruction not justified by any military necessity. The Israelis could offer no explanation that contradicted these factual findings. But where there was no military necessity, there was certainly a commercial opportunity. Sawafiri told the UN investigators that he and his family had supplied approximately 35% of the eggs on the market in Gaza. Egg prices soared due to the large number of chickens Israel destroyed. Gaza's stores are now full of frozen chickens supplied by Israeli firms." I don't know if that's me doing something here.
Is there a lab there? Maybe try the lab.
This is for recording. It's not amplification. Egg prices soared due to the large number of chickens Israel destroyed. Gaza stores are now full of frozen chickens supplied by Israeli firms. Israel has also repeatedly destroyed dairy processing plants. Israeli yogurt is a big seller in Gaza. And on January 4th, 2009, Israel bombed the Al-Badr flour mill, the last one still operating, destroying it completely. Again, UN investigators found no military necessity. But as the Goldstone report states, quote, "The consequences of the strike on the flour mill were significant. The population of Gaza is now more dependent on the Israeli authorities granting permission for flour and bread to enter the Gaza Strip. The family that owned the Al-Badr mill also ran a tomato canning factory and a diaper factory, both of which had closed down before the attack because Israel would not allow empty cans and other raw materials into Gaza. The fates of these and hundreds of other shuttered Gaza businesses illustrate that whatever economic destruction Gaza could not achieve with the blockade, it finished off with airstrikes. In fact, a few days ago, in the current attack, this process continues with the destruction of the Al-Awda factory. This was the largest private employer in Gaza, employed more than 500 people making ice cream and juice. Now you cannot, I mean, it may be the least of people's problems, but there's now no ice cream in Gaza. But more urgently, it was one of the few places where the Red Cross could store medicines that needed refrigeration at the Al-Awda factory, and it has now been totally destroyed in the past week due to Israeli bombing. Indeed, such is the chilling meticulousness of Israeli planning that in January 2008, almost a year before the invasion of Gaza, the Israeli Defense Ministry prepared a document detailing the minimum number of calories that Gaza residents would be permitted to consume according to demographic data such as sex and age. The Defense Ministry concluded that 106 truckloads of food per day would be just enough to meet a minimum level of, quote, nutrition that is sufficient for subsistence without the development of malnutrition. The military's analysis, published after a 3.5-year court battle waged by the Israeli monitoring group Gishah, includes detailed tables of how much domestic food production existed in Gaza before the invasion. Israeli military planners, according to their tables and data, were very familiar with how many chickens laid how many eggs and recommended setting what they called a minimum bar for the quantity of agricultural inputs, including eggs, for breeding allowed into Gaza. The military planners were also fully aware of the damaging effects of Israel's restrictions on imports of supplies and of the prohibition on exporting goods out of Gaza. The Defense Ministry calculated, for instance, that Gaza's production of fruit and vegetables would decline from 1,000 tons per day to 500 tons within a few months, meeting only 30% of the territory's needs. Gishah, the Israeli rights group, calculated that between 2007 and 2010, the amount of food Israel allowed into Gaza often fell far short of the minimum the Defense Ministry had set. While Israel eased restrictions on food imports in 2010, the main impact of the siege never disappeared. Destruction of productive capacity, poverty, unemployment, isolation, and dependence. It should be recalled whenever Israel boasts, as it often does, about how many hundreds of truckloads of supplies it allows into Gaza on any given day, that much of what comes in are Israeli consumer goods profiting Israeli companies. Even the food supplies bought by UN agencies for the majority of Palestinians in Gaza who rely on humanitarian assistance are purchased predominantly from Israeli companies and paid for with international aid money, another direct benefit to Israel. One statistic that comes from the UN that gives you a sense of the scale of the cumulative impact of this deliberate campaign to destroy Gaza's economy and the effect of the siege is that in 2000, the number of people who were reliant on direct food aid from the United Nations in Gaza was about 80,000 people. Today, and I'm talking about before the current war, the current attack, that number was over 800,000, more than half of Gaza's population. So from 2000 to today, 80,000 reliant on food aid to more than 800,000. Overall, the value of Israeli exports to the Palestinian Authority, the West Bank and Gaza Strip, grew from just over $2 billion in 2006 to $3.6 billion in 2011. So in other words, as Palestinians generally, and especially in Gaza, have gotten much, much poorer as a consequence of the siege, Israel's profits from Gaza have almost doubled. This puts the captive Palestinians among Israel's top 10 export destinations, ahead of the United Kingdom, Germany, France, India, Japan, and China. This bonanza, in the words of Shir Hever, an Israeli economic analyst, allows Israel's government and various Israeli companies to, quote, reap the profits while the international community pays the bill. The Palestinians' desperate need is turned into a lever to promote the prosperity of their occupiers, end quote. Meanwhile, restrictions on raw materials and so-called dual-use items remain in place, leaving much of Gaza's productive capacity and workforce idle. A stark indicator of what Israel has done to Gaza's economy is the number of truckloads of exports it allows out from those farms or factories that can still produce even under siege. In 2000, exports from Gaza peaked at more than 15,000 truckloads a year. From 2008 to 2012, during the years of the siege, Israel has permitted an average of just 162 truckloads of exports out of Gaza per year. That's about a dozen trucks per month. And the last time I checked for this year's figures from the United Nations, which monitors the crossings, it was 4 truckloads of exports per month out of Gaza, essentially zero. The destruction Israel has wrought on Gaza's economy is not incidental to its security policies. It has been a deliberate goal. As Sarah Roy of Harvard University points out, Israel has, quote, explicitly referred to its intensified closure or siege policy in Gaza as a form of economic warfare. Israeli officials even argued that damaging the enemy's economy is in and of itself a legitimate means in warfare and a relevant consideration, even while deciding to allow the entry of relief consignments. I will come back to this point when I talk about the current situation. Israel's goal is no longer simply Gaza's isolation and disablement, Roy states, but its abstraction and deletion. Israeli policy has shifted from addressing the economy in some manner, whether positively or negatively, to dispensing with the concept of an economy altogether. Israel now treats the economy in Gaza as a dispensable luxury. Its impact has been the near total collapse of the private sector, the traditional engine of economic growth there. Palestinians in Gaza have found creative ways around the formidable obstacles. One of the most spectacular sites I visited in Gaza was the tunnels dug deep under the border between Egypt and Gaza. My companions and I stood on the wooden planks of a large circular platform big enough to park 2 cars. The operator pressed the button and a warning horn sounded. A few seconds later, the platform began to descend down the deep cement-lined shaft, guided by steel rails, cables and motors on 2 sides. I was pretty impressed by this. I thought, what could these people in Gaza do if they were freed from this siege? They would have built a subway the length and breadth of Gaza by now. By some accounts, they have. In a few seconds, we were at the bottom of the shaft, some 30 meters below, the bright sky a mere circle high above. The air was cool and clammy and got cooler still as we walked off the platform into the tunnel mouth, which was wide enough for 1 car and felt perfectly secure. These aren't cars, people don't drive through in their cars, this was for importing large objects. This was only one of hundreds of tunnels serving as lifelines, although the vast majority were much smaller. The goods I saw entering Gaza included gravel, steel rebar, bags of cement, and bricks for construction. Some tunnels brought in gasoline, pumped through hoses, and then discharged into large plastic water tanks to be transported all over Gaza. Electric winches suspended over deep shafts hauled up large canvas baskets of gravel. Then workers slid the baskets sideways along an overhead rail and dumped the gravel into pits below. Trucks rolled down into the ramps, pick the cargo up and take it away. This underground economy has helped Gaza's. This underground economy has helped Gaza remain resilient, but at a desperately high price. Since 2006, at least 232 Palestinian workers have died in the tunnels, and hundreds more have been injured in what some call graveyards for the living. Nine of the dead were children. At least 20 of the workers were killed as a result of Israeli airstrikes intended to collapse the tunnels, but the poverty and unemployment in Gaza ensure that the lure of paid work, even under such dangerous conditions, remains irresistible. I visited the mouth of a tunnel that had collapsed just a day earlier, killing 19-year-old Hammadi Abu Shalouf from Rafah. Although Hamas-controlled authorities have regulated the tunnels to some extent on the Gaza side, including requiring tunnel owners to pay compensation for deaths and injuries, the long-term consequences of the move from a formal to an underground economy are likely to include further decay of Gaza's economy while significant parts of it shift into the hands of unaccountable clandestine organizations. The political motivations of the siege are underscored by the tacit support the blockade has always received from the Western-supported Fatah-controlled Palestinian Authority leadership in Ramallah, who bet that misery would help bring down Hamas and return them to power in Gaza. And this, of course, has been the motivation for US and European and Arab regime support for the siege of Gaza as well. But the tunnels, even though they helped people to survive the brutality of the Israeli siege, also left Gaza's economy vulnerable to major political shocks. And of course, the biggest was the US-backed military coup in Egypt on July 3rd, 2013. And the new Egyptian dictatorship of Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, with the full support of the United States and Israel, has moved to destroy all the tunnels that we visited that were a lifeline for people in Gaza. Within weeks of the coup, the volume of building materials and affordable food entering Gaza through the tunnels had plummeted by 80%, leading to an immediate spike in prices and a sharp slowdown in construction with an estimated loss of 30,000 jobs. Now, that provides some background for what has happened, because over the last year, the situation in Gaza has gotten steadily worse. The siege has left people utterly hopeless. When I've visited Gaza, and you don't need to visit Gaza to know this, because there are incredible writers in Gaza. Many of them are writing in Arabic and in English. You can read some of their writing at the Electronic Intifada. Will tell you that people are incredibly resilient when it comes to physical privation. You don't know how resilient you are, in a sense, until you're tested. I'm amazed at what people can put up with. That doesn't mean that we should be, that those privations are justifiable or tolerable. But what people really talk about as being the part that is insufferable, intolerable, is the isolation, the psychological isolation, the social isolation, and the cultural isolation that the siege has caused to 1.8 million people in Gaza. It's impossible to go to Gaza. Over the past 34 days, there haven't been international relief teams going to Gaza. There haven't been solidarity delegations going to Gaza. Nobody's allowed in, not from the Israeli side, not from the Egyptian side. I think that, in a sense, you talk to people in Gaza and the horror is unbearable. The knowledge that you and your entire family can be wiped out in a moment by indiscriminate shelling. And by the way, the shelling is completely indiscriminate. Israel is using howitzers. These are 155 millimeter howitzers, artillery shells. These are 40 kilogram shells that explode and spread shrapnel everywhere. And they're not that accurate. This is, you know, a World War II technology. And yes, there are computers that help you aim, but an artillery shell at the range Israel is firing them is still only accurate to about 300 feet. So when you're talking about shelling neighborhoods like Shuja'iyya in Gaza City, where in 300 feet or 100 feet, you have maybe dozens of families living, you're talking effectively about indiscriminate shelling. So the fear that people in Gaza have, I can't relate my own experience to it, but I think maybe it's only exceeded by the experience of those people with family in Gaza who cannot go home and be with them. And our friend Rifat al-Ara'ir, I hope that next time he's in Chicago, he could speak here in Evanston and at other libraries. He was here in the summer with a couple of the writers who contributed to the book he edited, Gaza Writes Back. And Gaza Writes Back is a collection of short fiction by young writers in Gaza written in English. It's an impressive book. And Rifat has lost more than 9 members of his extended family in this attack, including his brother, who was a very talented man, Muhammad al-Ara'ir, and among his claims to fame, he was the most popular children's TV character in Gaza, kind of the equivalent on Palestinian TV of Big Bird, called Karkur. And so even Karkur, even Big Bird, has not survived the Israeli attack. What can explain what's happening? Now, if you take the Israeli talking points, we want to be very balanced here and make sure that all views are heard. The Palestinians are just bad people. And their behavior is very strange. Israel left Gaza in 2005, right? We've heard this talking point before. And Palestinians could have turned Gaza into Singapore on the Mediterranean. And yet, for some strange reason that nobody can explain, all the scientists in white coats have studied the Palestinians, and they're just a bizarre and strange people. They decided instead of building skyscrapers and industrial parks and factories and stock exchanges, they decided to build rockets and to fire them at Israel. That's the narrative we hear constantly. Of course, I've written, and I can get into this in the Q&A, I won't go into all of the forensic detail now, but I'm happy to do that if anyone wants to take me on about it. The reality is that, there were no rockets fired by Hamas for the past 2 years until June 30th, 2014. 2 years, that was reported in the Times of Israel. And the reason for that is because in November 2012, you remember I mentioned that Israel bombarded Gaza in 2012. That ended with a ceasefire agreement that Palestinians saw as a victory. And the cover of my book, the young man on the cover of my book, was celebrating. This is on November 22nd, 2012. People were celebrating what they saw as a victory because through resistance, Palestinians had forced Israel to agree to a mutual ceasefire to end its attacks on Gaza and to end the siege, to open the crossings, to allow people in Gaza to breathe. And people saw that as a huge victory. And this is why this young man was celebrating. And I chose this image for the cover of the book because I thought it was such a hopeful image. I have never learned his name. I kept expecting since the book came out that Facebook would produce his name. So far it hasn't happened, and I hope it will. But I don't know today if this young man is dead or alive. There's a 1 in 1,000 chance that he's dead. But what happened in the past 2 years is that Israel never abided by the ceasefire agreement. In the first 3 months of the agreement, there wasn't a single rocket out of Gaza. A few rockets have been fired over the past 2 years, none of them by Hamas, by smaller groups. But Israel has acknowledged that Hamas always did its best to enforce the agreement and stop other groups from firing rockets. But during those first 3 months, there were dozens of Israeli attacks, and dozens of Palestinians were injured, and at least 4 were killed. And that's been the pattern. And there was no end to the siege. In fact, the siege has only got tighter. So what are the Palestinians now demanding as a condition for a ceasefire? Are they demanding that Israel be thrown into the sea? Are they demanding that Jews be made to suffer because they're Jewish? Are they demanding none of this? This is all fiction and fantasy that is being pushed out into the in the media. The demand that has come from Hamas, but more importantly than that, from across Palestinian civil society, this is a statement which we published at the Electronic Intifada called No Ceasefire Without Justice. It's signed by more than 100 notable members of Palestinian civil society, men and women, filmmakers, journalists, professors at the universities, including the Islamic University of Gaza, which was bombed and destroyed a week ago, judges in the courts in Gaza, you name it, across civil society. And their demands are end the siege. They put it like this. Charges in the media and by politicians of various stripes that accuse Hamas of ordering Gaza residents to resist evacuation orders and thus use them as human shields are untrue. With temporary shelters full and the indiscriminate Israeli shelling, there is literally no safe place in Gaza. Likewise, Hamas represented the sentiment of the vast majority of residents when it rejected the unilateral ceasefire proposed by Egypt and Israel without consulting anyone in Gaza. We share the broadly held public sentiment that it is unacceptable to merely return to the status quo in which Israel strictly limits travel in and out of the Gaza Strip, controls the supplies that come in, including a ban on most construction material, and prohibits virtually all exports, thus crippling the economy and triggering one of the highest poverty and unemployment rates in the Arab world. To do so would mean a return to a living death. Unfortunately, past experience has shown that the Israeli government repeatedly reneges on promises for further negotiations, as well as on its commitments to reform. Likewise, the international community has demonstrated no political will to enforce these pledges. Therefore, we call for a ceasefire only when negotiated conditions have result in the following: freedom of movement for Palestinians in and out of the Gaza Strip, unlimited import and export of supplies and goods, including by land, sea, and air, unrestricted use of the Gaza seaport, monitoring and enforcement of these agreements by a body appointed by the United Nations with appropriate security measures. Each of these expectations is taken for granted by most countries, and it is time for the Palestinians of Gaza to be accorded the human rights they deserve. And another piece that makes essentially the same case, Raji Surani, the director of the Palestinian Center for Human Rights, wrote in a piece called Why a Gaza Ceasefire Isn't Enough. He made the same case, but he makes an additional 2 points that are so important. One is that these are not demands. They are not political demands. These are basic, not even human rights. When you think of human rights, you think of highfalutin things. These are basic humanitarian rights. The right to eat, the right to be able to move in and out of your country that are denied by Israel. And the International Committee of the Red Cross has, to the chagrin of many Palestinians, not been a courageous organization when it comes to challenging Israel's abuses. But even the International Committee of the Red Cross has said that this siege is collective punishment. It is a war crime. It is a violation of the most basic commitments under the Fourth Geneva Convention. And so Palestinians are not demanding political concessions from Israel. They're demanding that Israel cease to violate their most basic humanitarian rights. And now when I mentioned in the book, when I read in the book about how Israel was trying to hold the entry of construction material and relief supplies into Gaza in exchange for concessions, this is exactly what's happening now. Israel is destroying Gaza systematically. The latest numbers today from the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, which I know I have here somewhere. In addition to 1,960 people killed, 386,000 people out of 1.8 million are still displaced in emergency shelters. The number of people permanently displaced is estimated at over 16,700 housing units have been destroyed or severely damaged. Israel has spared neither schools, nor mosques, nor factories. They destroyed. Did you hear about this? You know, when the Taliban destroyed the Bamiyan Buddhas, it was a story that everyone in the world heard. But when a few days ago, Israel destroyed the Great Mosque of Gaza, a building that has existed for 1,500 years, and that includes elements of a synagogue, and an early church, and a mosque dating back to the 1300s. It was destroyed. This was a building I visited, and it was a place of serenity. And when I was there, it gave me hope, because I said, Gaza is full of beauty. It's full of ancient things. This siege will end. This horror will end, and Gaza will become a place for its people and for people of the world to visit and to see. I did not know about the beauty and the heritage and the history that was in Gaza until I went and I saw the pride of the people in it. To be given a tour of that mosque by the people who lived in that community and who loved it was a very moving experience. And one of the things I came out of Gaza thinking, this is a place that has a future. Well, the Omari Mosque, the great mosque of Gaza, is no more. It was completely destroyed. Completely destroyed. So not only are we talking about the killing of 1 in 1,000 people, but we're talking about the destruction of their history and the destruction of their heritage. I'll end with this, with a few comments, and I know there's more I want to say, but I want to get to the Q&A. And I know that many things I didn't raise will come up. Gaza is only about, 2% or 3% of the land area of historic Palestine. And yet it's one of the most densely populated places on Earth. It's a beautiful place physically, and the people are incredible. But there's no place on Earth, I think, today that is so demonized, that is so despised, that is so misrepresented by the media, by politicians, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, who justify the murder going on, who don't talk about the siege, or if they do, they justify it, who talk about Palestinians as not even human, who blame Palestinians for their own deaths, who blame the victim. Palestinians in Gaza are the most despised people on earth. They are in the ghetto. They are in the ghetto. They are despised like the people in the ghetto once were. And this is happening with the full sight and consent of the world, and it's happening due in part to high-level incitement from Israeli politicians. I didn't mention Israel very much tonight in terms of its politics, but over the past few weeks and months, we've been documenting the statements made by Israeli leaders, like Ayelet Shaked, a rising star in the Israel in the Habeit HaYehudi party, which is one of the senior members of the coalition, who put a post on her Facebook page. It got thousands of likes, saying that the morality of war knows that it is not possible to refrain from hurting enemy civilians. She talks about the destruction of Dresden and the atomic bombs, and she says, and in our war, this is sevenfold more correct, because the enemy soldiers hide out among the population, and it is only through its support that they can fight. Behind every terrorist stand dozens of men and women without whom he could not engage in terrorism. Actors in the war are those who incite in mosques, who write the murderous curricula for schools, who give shelter, who provide vehicles, and all those who honor and give them their moral support. They are all enemy combatants, and their blood shall be on all their heads. Now, this also includes the mothers of martyrs, who send them to hell with flowers and kisses. They should follow their sons. Nothing would be more just. They should go, as should the physical homes in which they raised the snakes. Otherwise, more little snakes will be raised. There was no outcry in Israel when Ayelet Shaked, one of the best-known lawmakers, said that Palestinian mothers should be killed because they give birth to little snakes. She didn't lose her job. Nobody asked her to resign. Likewise, when Moshe Feiglin, the deputy speaker of the Knesset just the other day, called for Palestinians in Gaza to be put into concentration camps. Those are the words he used in Hebrew. And for any resistance to be exterminated. Tent encampment, he said, the Israeli army must designate certain open areas on the Sinai border adjacent to the sea in which the civilian population will be concentrated far from the built-up areas that are used for launches and tunneling. The supply of electricity and water to the formerly populated areas will be disconnected, he adds. Then he calls for Palestinians to be expelled from Gaza and for it to be repopulated with Jews. These are really, without exaggeration, calls for genocide. And they happen from senior politicians without consequence, and with our politicians here from, you know, Democrat to Republican, praising our shared values with Israel and what a wonderful democracy Israel is. There's something wrong there. And what it comes down to is this. The reason 1.8 million Palestinians are caged up in Gaza, the reason Palestinians are still in refugee camps in Lebanon, in Jordan, in the West Bank, the reason Israel is building walls around Palestinians in Tulkarem, walling them out of Jerusalem, building a wall around Bethlehem that even the Pope found to be disturbing. I say even the Pope because the Pope doesn't speak out on political issues very much. And the reason for this is one reason alone. What is it that Palestinians lack or possess that makes them outsiders to be excluded in so many brutal ways? It's that in Israel, they cannot fit in because Israel defines itself as a Jewish state. And this is the crux of the problem I address in the book. And the question, does Israel have a right to exist as a Jewish state? I just saw my friend Omar Ghraib in Gaza tweet before I started talking. He says, I want my belief in peace back. I'm paraphrasing him, so I forgive if I misquote him. But someone living through the horror in Gaza, many people, have not given up on the idea of justice, not given up on the idea of equality, not given up on the idea of this horror ending, and therefore, nor should we. And I believe that there is still a future for Gaza, for Palestinians. I believe there's a future in which Israeli Jews and Palestinians live without racial distinction, without religious and racial segregation and apartheid. And that future is one we need to work for more desperately than ever, along with accountability and justice for these horrible and ongoing crimes. Thank you. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Noor, and my question is that given the existing police brutality towards unarmed black youth and the violence towards people of color in general in this country and the power of the Zionist lobby in this country, what can we do as young people? What career should we pursue to challenge existing structures that allow discrimination and racism and prejudice to persevere in this country?
Thank you. That's such an important question, and I didn't address it tonight because I wanted to talk about Gaza, but it is the first question I pose in the book. I really felt I had to start there because, you know, in this country, to talk about injustice, especially racial injustice, in Palestine, without talking about racial injustice in this country, to me, is unethical. And as a practical matter, we, you know, when I sat down and thought about these things and learned from others who are working on them, you really see the connection. And some of the connections I point out in this book, for example, is the level of cooperation between U.S. police forces. I'm talking about almost every big city police force in this country, including the Chicago Police Department, and Israel. There's practically, you know, like a conveyor belt taking U.S. police top brass. The Chicago Police Department, they've been on these junkets at least twice, the head of every division. And they take them to places like Megiddo Prison, where Palestinians like Arafat Jaradat have been tortured to death, where Palestinian children are held in solitary confinement. Israel is the only country in the world that sends children, and of course only Palestinian children, to military tribunals. And before these children go to military tribunals, they're held in places like Megiddo Prison and Al-Jalameh Interrogation Center, which among the security contractors there is a company called G4S. This is one of the biggest prison contractors in the world and in this country. So you have prisons, juvenile centers, county, state, and federal prisons which G4S runs or operates in all over the country. So as a practical matter, when we're talking about campaigns, there's a very big global campaign to end G4S's complicity in Israeli occupation and Israeli human rights abuses of Palestinians. But G4S is involved in abuses against migrants who are being held in detention camps in Australia, in Manus Island. It was responsible It's two of its agents are going on trial in the UK in the death of Jimmy Mubenga, a man that they were forcibly deporting. And so if we're going to attack and end mass incarceration in this country, then we have to understand that the forces that support mass incarceration, that support the prison industry, that support border militarization, are the same political forces and companies profiting and gaining from support for Israel. And this is very real. So, you know, Israel has marketed itself as this big homeland security expert and destination. And so they're very aggressively marketing to U.S. police forces. And these so-called technologies that are imported from Israel, they're, I mean, some of the cases I document in the book, they're just repackaged racial profiling. But you can say, oh, but it's Israeli expertise. It's this fancy thing they developed in the tough neighborhood of the Middle East. So even using this racialized language. And what does that mean that Israelis are good at this? If, you know, good in quotes. It means they've been experimenting on millions of Palestinians who've been deprived of their rights for decades. And already there was an article in Haaretz the other day about how the war on Gaza is going to be a boon for Israeli weapons companies who can say our weapons are field tested. So the field testing is on Palestinians and the implementation is here. That's how you can explain that earlier this year the Obama administration gave a $145 million contract to Elbit Systems, one of the Israeli arms companies absolutely soaked in blood, Palestinian, Lebanese, and other blood, to build a fence along part of the Arizona border. So the connections are material, and these connections are being made at the level of work on the ground by Students for Justice in Palestine, by students in Mecha, the largest Chicano and Chicana student organization in this country. And to me, that's the future. These battles have to be fought together. And we have to be working on the, you know, we live in this country. We cannot simply talk about Palestine without talking about and acting on what's happening here.
I was writing in the London Review of Books, a former member of the British Foreign Office argues that the de facto Israeli policy for decades is one of what he terms permanent impermanency. It serves them to have an indeterminate situation, allowing them to continue to take over the West Bank, the Jordan Valley, staying in the Golan Heights and taking over more and more of Jerusalem. Please comment.
I think that's absolutely right, and that's what the so-called peace process became over the last 20 years, and certainly the last more recent years, and it worked like this. I mean, the Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir said it, you know, a generation ago in his memoirs. I mean, he talked about the peace process that began in 1990. He said, we would talk for 10 years. My plan was to talk for 10 years while building settlements. And in the meantime, we would double the number of settlements. Well, he was pessimistic because they've been talking for 20 years and building settlements, taking land from Palestinians with no significant opposition from governments or from the United Nations or from any of the institutions that are supposed to function. You know, you look at the horror that's going on in Iraq, and you look at you know, and most of that horror has been caused by intervention and by U.S. war. But people still ask the question. They say, what should we do? Nobody says, what should we do about Gaza? Nobody talks about U.S. airstrikes on the Israeli army. No one talks about airdropping food on a population that is trapped. Nobody asks, would arming the Palestinians help them win their liberation? I mean, let's be clear. Palestinians have the right to resist like any other people under occupation. But it's been become criminalized even to say that. I mean, I'm not a violent person. I don't support violence. I always look for an alternative to violence. There should always, we should exhaust every effort. But I can't say to people who are living under a brutal, decades-long occupation with no sign of salvation that you just have to sing Kumbaya. You know, who else do we tell that to? You know, in the media in this country, when there were all these reports on ABC in the media, when there were these stories, I don't know if they were true or not, that Syrian rebels were using an iPad to aim a mortar. And there were all these stories in the media saying, oh, look how smart and clever they are. They're using iPads to aim mortars. Nobody ever would say, look how smart and clever the Palestinians are to be able to mount a military resistance against such a powerful enemy. This is a taboo in this country. But the question we have to ask is, if you are living in those conditions of permanent impermanency, if you are watching Israel take your land decade after decade, if you were in a giant prison and you couldn't get in and out, would you fight back? Would you fight back?
Yes. Warsaw Ghetto. Sorry, people don't want to hear that.
So in the 90s, Israel put a lot of effort into trying to build up the economy of Gaza and the West Bank. And I know this because I was there and I was involved with that. We built a lot of things in Gaza and the West Bank. And a lot of the situation today in Gaza, if you took a careful look at the timeline, is a result of violence that was launched from Gaza and responses from Israel. And as a matter of fact, the West Bank, which has been less likely to embrace violence, is doing much better economically. Even this week, we had attacks on the border crossings that control the food going out by Palestinians mortaring the very people who let food in and out. So my question is, from your book, you seem to be against this type of economic cooperation and the building of medium-income housing and the building of factories and all of that. It strikes me from your book, if I understood it correctly, that you don't think this is a good thing for the Palestinians. So I'd like to understand, do you feel that economic development of the Palestinian territories would be better than embracing violence? And where has it really gotten the Palestinians? Mm-hmm.
Well, that was a masterful recitation of talking points that we've been hearing for years. And that, a salad made of, you take a few facts from here, you take a little bit from there, and you make a salad. And that was a very delicious salad, but empty of calories completely and empty of nutrition. When you say Israel built a lot in the West Bank, and then you said we built a lot, I was confused who the we is there. Is that, are you speaking as an Israeli or as an American? I didn't get.
Am I allowed to dialogue?
Yes. So, we're all about dialogue.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to have you here in Evanston. It's nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
So I spent about 25 years of my life in the Middle East, including Jordan and Israel. And what I did...
In what capacity?
A lot of what I did was I worked on the economic development between Arabs and Israelis.
For whom?
Sometimes I was paid by Arabs, sometimes I was paid by Israel.
Arabs is a very big category.
I was paid by several Jordanian corporations. I was paid by a couple of Israeli corporations. I was paid by the Foreign Office for a while.
Okay, so...
The Israeli Foreign Office. Sorry.
Okay, so, all right, thank you. Well, of course, this narrative that, which I addressed briefly, that we did so much, and we left Gaza, and we could have done this. Of course, I talk in the book, and this is why I hope people pick up the book. I mean, it's utter nonsense. What Israel has done over the past four decades since 1967 is to absolutely consolidate its control over the Palestinian economy, not to allow significant development. And one of the myths in recent years has been this myth of a booming West Bank, which I demolish in the book. And I did so because it's a myth that's been repeated by the likes of Thomas Friedman and others, that, oh, the recalcitrant Palestinians in Gaza, because of their stubborn insistence on electing the people they want to represent them instead of electing the people we want to represent them, you know, they are suffering because of their own recalcitrance. Whereas the people in the West Bank are booming. It's utter nonsense. There are small pockets of prosperity in the West Bank. Not prosperity, consumption. Conspicuous consumption, particularly in Ramallah. This is fueled by a credit binge. It's fueled by international aid money. And it's what I call neoliberal Palestine, where you have a small Palestinian elite that has done extremely well over the past 20 years, while the vast majority of Palestinians in the West Bank have gotten poorer and poorer. And in many areas in the West Bank, you're furrowing your brows as if what I'm saying is somehow strange or bizarre. But the good thing about this book is it's all fully documented, and you can look up everything I say. Now, in many parts of the West Bank, in recent years, the malnutrition has been worse than in Gaza. In large parts of the West Bank, particularly so-called Area C, more than 65% of the West Bank, where Israel has allowed no development at all. Palestinians can't build houses on their land, they can't dig wells, they can't dig factories. Of course, nobody builds a factory when they know that Israel could demolish at any moment. You can't build an economy in an arbitrary and tyrannical system like Israel's military occupation. Now, you talked about a lot of international aid projects. That's true. The European Union built all kinds of projects. Many of them were destroyed by Israel, particularly in Gaza, but also on the West Bank. And let's have some accountability. Let's send Israel the bill.
Hi, thank you so much for being here today. So I'm actually a student at Northwestern University, right up the street, particularly Zionist institution. And I was wondering if you could talk. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit on the role of SJP, Students for Justice in Palestine, and specifically the role of university divestments.
Well, now we get from problems to solutions, because I truly believe that Students for Justice in Palestine is part of the solution. And there are people in this country who try to present this issue as a religious issue or an ethnic issue. They try to pit Palestinians against Jewish people. They try to pit Arabs against Americans or Muslims against Christians. And to me, the greatest testimony that this is nonsense, that this is really an issue about justice and human rights that anybody can understand, is Students for Justice in Palestine. Because I've been able to travel around this country. That's one of the privileges I've had in writing this book. And to meet SJP, not just Students for Justice in Palestine groups, but many other groups with similar missions and different names, and what strikes me is the diversity. It's incredible. You cannot stereotype these groups. Yes, there are Palestinian students, but there are queer students. There are Muslim students. There are Asian students. There are Jewish students. In some cases, Students for Justice in Palestine chapters are led by Jewish students. And to me, this embodies the spirit of the future that we are working for. It really does. It's an inclusive future. It's one that's not based on ethnic or religious identification, but solidarity based on a just struggle for everybody's rights. And Students for Justice in Palestine is really at the forefront of making this case. As a generation ago, their parents or aunts or uncles or whatever were doing in the struggle for divestment from companies profiting and assisting from apartheid South Africa. And increasingly, the people are winning over the argument, because you can't tell people you can do nothing. All right, you're not armed resistance is a taboo. Okay, we don't want armed resistance. So nonviolent resistance is also out to the people who say no boycott, divestment, and sanctions. What do they want us to do? They want us to sit there singing Kumbaya while Israeli bulldozers take the land and build settlements. And what the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement says, and what SJP says, is no. We're going to impose a cost for this. We're going to say there's a price to complicity in this. Justice can't wait forever, but we're going to do it in an ethical struggle, a principled struggle, and one that is really based on universal principles. To me, that's what Students for Justice in Palestine is doing. And the work I mentioned with groups like Mecha is so important. It's really inspiring. And in the book, in the chapter, The War on Campus, I don't talk about Northwestern. I talk about Northeastern, different university. But I do talk about the role that university administrations have played, the complicity in trying to suppress this movement. And many students have paid a price for it. You know, they have been harassed, they have been persecuted. In extreme cases, they have been prosecuted. And we've seen pro-Israel groups abusing civil rights law in this country to file bogus civil rights complaints against campuses to claim that Palestine solidarity activism, somehow endangers Jewish students. And there have been a number of these cases filed. I discuss them in the book. In every case that's been adjudicated so far by the Office of Civil Rights of the U.S. Department of Education, the claims have turned out to be utterly bogus. But what they do, and I think what they're intended to do, is to have a chilling effect to try and deter people from getting involved, to say, oh, you're going to be put through the ringer, your career prospects are going to suffer, you know, just don't make any noise about this. That's the way it's working. This is why we have this attack on Stephen Salaita now at the University of Illinois. It's not a coincidence that Stephen Salaita was one of the most outspoken and effective advocates of the boycott of Israeli academic institutions that are directly complicit in these human rights abuses. It's no coincidence they targeted him. They want to send a message that if you speak out, if you put your head above the water, you're going to get shot down. And I think what's very important is that, you know, if it's just a few isolated people speaking up, it's easy to pick them off. But this movement has reached such critical mass that they cannot stop it now. And it's very important, especially with what's happening in Gaza, that we take it to the next level.
Hi, my name is Gabriel. I was a director of Students for Justice in Palestine at Florida State University for about 3 years. Thank you for coming. This is really cool.
Thank you.
So here's my question. I would like for you to comment on the ideology of Zionism. Is Zionism inherently flawed, racist? Is it inherently demand apartheid? Or is there a form of Zionism in which Palestinian rights and self-determination can be preserved while also serving itself, while kind of continuing itself? I've heard and I've seen a lot more people starting to talk about post-Zionism or non-Zionism as opposed to anti-Zionism. Does it benefit our movement to label ourselves strictly anti-Zionist? Does it actually further the Palestinian cause? Or can Palestinian rights be accommodated within the context of a different kind of Zionism?
Okay. That's a question that I'm going to refer you in part to the chapter, Does Israel Have a Right to Exist as a Jewish State? Because you're asking a set of questions that are important and difficult to deal with sort of in a 30-second or even a 3-minute reply. But I'll say this. Is a non-racist Zionism theoretically possible on the moon? Maybe. But if Zionism means a state with a Jewish majority in historic Palestine, then that vision cannot be implemented without massive and continuous violation of the rights of millions of Palestinians. And it could not have been started without that violation, because the only way you could create a Jewish state in most of historic Palestine was through the ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians, the physical removal of Palestinians. in the way that indigenous peoples have been removed historically from other settler colonial states. I view Israel and Zionism through the lens of settler colonialism. And in order to maintain a predominantly or majority Jewish space within historic Palestine, I argue, and I would say I demonstrate in the book, that the rights of Palestinians have to be continuously violated. This includes, of course, Palestinians in the West Bank. It includes Palestinian citizens of Israel in various degrees. And there are so-called liberal Zionists or post-Zionists who argue that the violation of the rights of Palestinian citizens of Israel is not necessary. But that is not what the history and actual practice of Israel show. That's why Palestinian citizens of Israel don't have equal access to land, because of the relentless effort to Judaize their land. Gaza is the extreme case. Gaza is the extreme case, and the vision for Gaza was laid out, I think, most succinctly in 2004 by Arnon Sofer, the Haifa University professor, who was the advisor to then-Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon, when they did the so-called Gaza disengagement, which is to pull out the 7,000 Israeli settlers and to move Israeli occupation forces from the interior to the perimeter and to impose a land, sea, and air blockade. Arnon Sofer, like other Israeli commentators and politicians, has said the main reason for the Gaza disengagement, as they call it, was demographic, that there are a lot of Palestinians there. If we somehow fence Gaza off, you know, hey presto, by magic, you've subtracted, 1.5 million at the time Palestinians from the population, and Israel's Jewish majority magically increases. And this is what Arnon Sofer said in 2004 about what the vision was for Gaza. He said, "What will be?" He says they called it unilateral separation. Unilateral separation does not guarantee peace. It guarantees a Jewish Zionist state with an overwhelming majority of Jews. What will be the price of this achievement? The day after, Palestinians will bombard us with artillery and we will have to retaliate. But at least the war will be at the fence, not in the kindergartens of Tel Aviv and Haifa. We will tell the Palestinians that if a single missile is fired over the fence, we will fire 10 in response, and women and children will be killed and houses will be destroyed. Further down the line, when 2.5 million people live in a closed-off Gaza, it's going to be a human catastrophe. Those people will be even bigger animals than they are today, with the aid of an insane fundamentalist Islam. The pressure at the border will be awful. It's going to be a terrible war. So if we want to remain alive, we will have to kill and kill and kill all day, every day. And then he says this: if we don't kill, we will cease to exist. The only thing that concerns me is how to ensure that the boys and men who are going to have to do the killing will be able to return home to their families and be normal human beings. Now, in Arnon Sofer's estimation, this was the price that Israel had to pay to remain a Jewish state. That this is what Israel had to do to Gaza to subtract that population and keep it physically separated. And it was a price he was willing to pay. And it was a price that 90% of Israeli Jews tell pollsters they're willing to pay. And politicians like Ayelet Shaked, Benjamin Netanyahu, Moshe Feiglin, and others are all willing to pay. And to justify, and to believe in, and to refuse to hear any alternative, to refuse to consider that there's something wrong with this picture. So if the extreme case is acceptable to 90% of Israeli Jews, then the vast majority, and polls by the Israel Democracy Institute show this, have no problem with depriving Palestinian citizens of Israel of basic rights like voting, of access to land. Job discrimination is perfectly acceptable, and so on and so forth. The most extreme case, massacring people to maintain Jewish supremacy within a majority state, is okay. So what isn't okay? That's the problem Israel is at now. And, you know, the Moshe Feiglins of the world are not shy about what they believe. But in a sense, in this country, we don't have as many Moshe Feiglins. What we have is more Peter Beinarts. You know, the so-called liberal Zionists who will not confront the price that they're asking Palestinians to pay for Israel to maintain a Jewish majority state. And I think where we're heading now is the broader recognition that that's impossible. You couldn't ever have a Jewish majority state in a country that had a Jewish minority without tremendous violence, and you can't maintain it without tremendous violence. So if we want to get away from violence, if we want to end this, it's not going to be through more walls, it's not going to be through more bombs, it's not going to be through more iron domes. It's going to be by dismantling the system of racial supremacy. And that system of racial supremacy in the context of Palestine is called Zionism. I think people have to start going. What I'm concerned about is that the library officially closes at 9, and I know that there are people who work here who are staying later than their usual hours, and I don't want to keep them too much later. So maybe one more question, and then we could move to the books. I could stay, now that I'm here, I could stay much longer, but, you know.
I have a question, but quickly before that, I just wanted to say that the right to defend and resist is one of the articles under the Protocol of International Human Rights, which is the minimum rights for the people, for the nation. So people have the right to resist and defend their countries. That's number one. So number two, my question is this. Why can't we just come out and say enough is enough? We talk about the crimes. We talk about, you know, going and killing and systematic killing and, you know, surrounding people with no food, no electricity, no medicine, no, you know, dignity and all that. This is a concentration camp. That's exactly, they said, we are going to make a concentration. No, it's past. Gaza is concentration camp, and this is not a war, it is genocide. Why can't we just say as it is?
Well, I think people are increasingly, you know, there's always a lot of nervousness about using the G word, you know, talking about genocide. But when you look at statements like Moshe Feiglin and you compare them to the Genocide Convention, they actually fit the legal definition of incitement to genocide, because it's not just about the crimes he wants to commit. Genocide is a crime of intent. It's about the destruction of a people in whole or in part. And Moshe Feiglin, as an example, there are others like him, but he's the deputy speaker of the Knesset, makes clear his intent, that it is the destruction of a community as a community. He says it doesn't exist. He says there is no such thing as two states for two peoples. There is one people and one state. And, of course, Israeli Jews are the one people he's talking about. But I think let's end on something. Let's talk about accountability. Because, you know, we in the United States have a special responsibility. This could not be happening without the support of the United States. It could not be happening. It could not be happening without the support of President Obama personally. I hold him personally responsible, because he's one of the very few people on this planet who has the power to stop it. You know, people often say, oh, the president, he doesn't have that much power. No, he has the power to stop it. There was a choice a few weeks ago when Israel asked for resupply of the ammunition, of the mortar bombs and the artillery shells that it's indiscriminately firing on Gaza. And the president could have said no. But instead, they sent those stocks to Israel. Amnesty International the other day called for the U.S. to impose an arms embargo on Israel and called on the United States specifically to stop a shipment of jet fuel that is used for military jets that's on its way to Israel now. I do not believe that 448 Palestinian children would have been killed in the past 34 days if the Obama administration had not done everything in its power to block accountability under the Goldstone Report for Israel's previous massacre in Gaza. The U.S. mobilized every political and diplomatic resource to make sure that the Israelis who gave the orders in 2008 would not be held accountable. And because of that, I believe people are dead now. We must make sure this doesn't happen again. We can't count on the government. There is unprecedented energy in this country and around the world. You look in London, there have been hundreds of thousands of people marching. Cape Town on Saturday had its biggest protest since the end of apartheid. Since the end of apartheid, they had their biggest protest in South Africa, and it was for Gaza. And it's happening in Chicago. There have been thousands of people going to the demonstrations downtown. We have to make sure that this energy and this passion is turned into sustained campaigns for justice, that we don't have to look back in 2 years or 3 years or 4 years and see this again. The one thing we can learn from the history, and this is a lesson I talk about in depth in this book, I don't pretend South Africa is a utopia. There's a lot of problems there, and I write about them. I don't pretend Ireland is a utopia. But what those places teach us, and those are lessons we have to learn, is that situations that everyone writes off and says this is intractable, it's been going on for generations, there's no solution, there can never be peace in South Africa, there can never be peace in Ireland, that they were proven wrong. And we have to understand why they were proven wrong. What did it take to break those situations? And it took, in each case, doing pretty much the exact opposite of what we're doing now. Now we're supporting the strong. We support occupation. We support those who commit massive human rights abuses, not just in Palestine, but in Egypt, throughout the region. Where there is dictatorship, the United States stands behind it, in Egypt right now. Hundreds of people were killed by the coup regime, and thousands, perhaps tens of thousands, are in prison, including an American called Mohammed Sultan, who the Obama administration has abandoned. You never hear his name. American politicians are more likely to utter the name of an Israeli soldier believed kidnapped is their word, captured, than of an American held by the Egyptian dictatorship or even by Israel.